When I went to college, we had a mascot, like most colleges. We were the Crusaders. Well, at least we were at the beginning of my time as a student there. By the time I graduated, we weren't. The college had decided that they would best leave behind the imagery of the Crusades and the Crusaders. And so they had this committee with staff and faculty and students that came up with a new mascot. And they had this sort of pep rally to announce their decision to the student body, and we're all there, and they talked about why they were changing it, and they said, okay, and we don't have the actual mascot, but we've got the name of it, and we're going to be the Thunder, and we're going to have a new group come up with what that's going to be pictured as, and we're all like, Thunder? Like, how do you picture Thunder? How do you represent Thunder? Like, okay, clouds, maybe a lightning bolt, what else can you do? Well, the next week, one of the Old Testament Bible professors wrote the funniest thing I have ever read. He wrote a letter to the editor, to the student paper. And in there, he suggested that if we're going to be the Wheaton College Thunder, perhaps our mascot should be Baal. Now, he repeatedly said, I'm just kidding. But maybe we should be the Baal mascot. Because Baal was known as the god of thunder. He was supposedly the god, lowercase g, of storm and lightning and thunder and even of sun and heat, right? And so if that's what his association was, hey, let's use that. I've never forgotten that. Why do I share this? You need to know something about Baal's reputation to fully appreciate the passage before us this morning. Baal was supposed to be in charge of, authoritative over the storm, the thunder, lightning, rain, those things. Now, don't worry, they did not choose Baal as their mascot. They chose a mastodon, which is a whole nother story. Not impressive. You also need to understand the backdrop of our passage this morning. As Jason read from the beginning of chapter 18, it was the third year. And in context, it means the third year of the drought, third year of famine because there hadn't been rain. If we go back to 1 Kings 17, the previous chapter, verse 1, we read, "Now Elijah the Tishbite of Tishbe in Gilead said to Ahab, 'As the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, before whom I stand, there shall be neither dew nor rain these years except at my word.'" God, through the prophet Elijah, told Ahab, king of Israel, you're not going to have any rain until Elijah prays for it to rain. And it's going to last years. And that's exactly what happened. As James chapter 5, verses 17 and 18 tell us, Elijah was a man with a nature like ours, and he prayed fervently that it might not rain. And for 3 years and 6 months, it did not rain on the earth. Then he prayed again, and heaven gave rain, and the earth bore its fruit. And so when we come to chapter 18, which Jason read aloud, realize that we're coming at the tail end of this 3.5 year period. A 3.5 year period where Israel has been in the most extreme of droughts, where not only has it been dry, it hasn't rained at all for 3.5 years. There hasn't even been so much as dew in the morning. It's been dry, 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 dry. That's really important to understand for context, and we're going to come back to that. Now, at the beginning of 18, Elijah the prophet comes to a man named Obadiah. Obadiah is an administration official for Ahab. Ahab is king of Israel, the people of God, but he's an ungodly man. He's a wicked, pagan, evil man. And Ahab has been on the lookout for Elijah. Elijah comes to Obadiah, who serves the king, says, hey, I want to meet with your boss. Arrange a meeting for me. Obadiah kind of flips out. He's like, you know, there's been an APB out on you everywhere for a long time. And if I go tell him that you're here and then you disappear by the time I get back with the king, you're going to kill me. And Elijah assures him, no, I'm not leaving. This is showdown time. Bring him. We're going to meet. So the king comes. Verse 17. When Ahab saw Elijah, Ahab said to him, is it you, you troubler of Israel? Might I suggest that's not the best way to talk to godly men? I mean, it's not. But it's how this evil king addresses the prophet Elijah. Well, why? There was a hint of truth in it, in that this prophet was the reason that there hadn't been rain for 3.5 years, or at least the means by which God was doing this. It's been 3.5 years because of Elijah's prayers. 3.5 years of national catastrophe because God had been answering this guy's prayers. Heard a story years ago about a youth pastor who had a girl in his youth group that just wasn't following Jesus. And so he began to pray, God, do whatever you need to do in this girl's life to get her attention and get her turned towards Jesus. That weekend, she was in a car crash that nearly killed her, changed her life. She began following Jesus. And this girl's parents were mad at this youth pastor for praying that. And it was like, wait a minute. He didn't pray that she get hurt. He didn't pray that she get in a car accident. He prayed that God would do whatever God saw fit to turn her towards Jesus. And the parents were mad about that. This youth pastor didn't tamper with her brake lines. He asked God to do something. Who did the parents really have a beef with? They had a beef with God, not the youth pastor. And here, Ahab's real beef is not with Elijah, who's doing the praying. His real beef is with God, who's answering the prayers. And he's angry, and he's mad. And there will always be those willing to harass and persecute and criticize and even kill godly men and women. And it can come from religious people. Ahab was not Jewish in the sense of practicing Judaism, focusing on Yahweh. But he was religious. He was pagan. He was focused on Baal and Asherah and others. And he responds very, very poorly to the man who's faithful to God. But you got to dig Elijah's response. It's a two-part response. First, verse 18. And he, Elijah, answered, I have not troubled Israel, but you have, and your father's house, because you have abandoned the commandments of the Lord and followed the Baals. Elijah says, you got it all backwards. I'm not the one that's causing a problem. We have a problem because you and your family that has led our nation has turned us away from God. You've said no to obeying God, no to following God, and you've turned us to false gods. That's where the problem really lies. Elijah understood something that's so easy to forget. Faithfulness to the one and only true God is always, always more important, more significant than temporal issues, even big deal temporal issues like drought and famine. It's always first and foremost about God himself. And anybody who leads us away from the one true God is really the source of our problem, our trouble. The second part of Elijah's response, verse 19. Now therefore, now that I've established that you're the problem, king, now therefore send and gather all Israel to me at Mount Carmel, and the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table. Gutsy. Very, very gutsy. Elijah basically throws down the gauntlet and says, showdown time, king. Bring me an audience. I want a crowd for this. Bring all Israel to me. Now, it's not literally every single person in the nation, but like get as many people to this event as you can. Bring an audience and bring the 950 pagan prophets that you and the queen maintain at the palace. The 450 prophets of Baal, the 400 prophets of Asherah, these two false pagan deities. Bring the whole pagan prophet team. And it's meet up on Mount Carmel. Now, if this were an old Western movie, the hero gunslinger who's been absentee just walked into town, kicked open the saloon doors, walked right up to the villain and tweaked his nose and said, let's get out on the main street for a showdown. Gunslinging duel. High noon, let's go. The entire city shows up to watch, except instead of a one-on-one old Western gun shooting duel, it's 450 to 1. 450 prophets of Baal against one Elijah. And they got another 400 prophets of Asherah in the wings on the sidelines cheering them on. This is insane. I mean, if you picture that old Western scene, can you imagine 450 people on the one end of the street and one on the other end? That's not a fair fight at all, right? My kids have this line that they quote from a TV thing about Connect Four. Hey, there's 18 of us. Let's play Connect Four. You can't play Connect Four with 18 people. That's not enough people. That's kind of what's going on here. You can't take down the one God with 450 false prophets. That's not enough. Of course, there's never enough. There will never be enough evil men, evil women, false prophets to really stand up and overcome the one true God. I would love to talk to Elijah someday and ask him how he felt when he gave this challenge. I'd love to hear how he did it. Was he terse and just really clipped language? Did he have some disdain for the king in his voice? Did he maybe have a little bit of godly swagger in his tone and how he delivered it? I don't know. But I can't imagine that it was really timid. King, what do you think? Could we do this? I don't think it was like that. I think he had some confidence and courage in God. Now, we're about to come to a key part of this. If I asked you about Jonah, Old Testament prophet Jonah, what's the first thing that comes into your mind? The fish, right? First association is the fish. The book of Jonah is not about the fish. The fish is not the heartbeat of the story of Jonah. The heartbeat of our passage this morning is not about the fire. It's not. The heartbeat is found in verses 20 and 21. So Ahab sent to all the people of Israel and gathered the prophets together at Mount Carmel. And Elijah came near to all the people and said, "How long will you go limping between two different opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal, then follow him." That's the point of this whole chapter, right there. Who is your God? Who are you going to treat as God? Who are you going to follow in your life as God? That is the central issue. That is the overriding issue of this whole passage. And really, the central issue of the scripture and life. Will you treat God as God? Or will you follow an idol? Will you follow a false God? How long are you going to do this? Well, how long? Because they're already not following the one true God. He says, how long will you go on limping between two different opinions? Limping, key language here. They had one foot on one path, one foot on the other path. They're trying to follow God with part of their life, trying to follow Baal with another part. They're being pulled in two different directions as they refuse to make up their minds. They're sitting on the fence, trying to have the best of both worlds, and it doesn't work. It doesn't work. He's calling them, make up your mind. Who will you worship exclusively as God? In marriage, we commit ourselves exclusively to one man or one woman, right? There's no playing of the field. There's no, well, I'm going to spend Fridays with her and Tuesdays and Thursdays with this other lady. It's one and one alone. God is one and one alone. He will not share the stage with others. How long will you, Israel, keep going and trying to have it both ways? And what does the crowd do? He's got this whole crowd of Israel there, and he challenges them, and he calls them out, and how do they respond? Chapter 18, verse 21b. And the people did not answer him a word. Can you feel the agony, the tragedy of that silence? And the people did not answer him a word. Awkward silence. They refused to respond. They refused to recognize and decide. They're still limping between two opinions, even while this prophet is calling them out for it. They cannot and they will not make up their minds. Now, we can look at that from a distance 3,000 or more years later and say, oh, those guys, same thing today. Now, none of us is tempted to follow the Old Testament Baal, but we don't struggle to find alternatives to treat as God. We try to follow God, and we try to follow the world. Matthew 6:24, Jesus says, "No one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money." And here in America, we often tend to try to limp between those two. Do I love my stuff? Do I love money and what money can buy me? Or do I want to follow God? And we go on trying with one foot on each of those paths. And so the question that Elijah would ask Christians today is, how long will you go on limping between two different opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if money, if wealth, if the things that money can get you is your God, follow that. How long will you go limping between two different opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if your kids or your grandkids or your extended family is your priority, then follow that. How long will you go limping between two different opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if sports or recreation or prestige or the vacation house or hunting or fishing or fashion or popularity or being right or having things the way that you like them is your God, then follow that. If we hear this story, if we hear these words and think this test, this challenge is for someone else, we're deceiving ourselves. Not a one of us here is above temptation, is above being drawn into worshiping and adoring and focusing on and prioritizing something other than God. Not a one of us. Let me give you a few questions to help you assess. Where is it in my life that I'm maybe being tempted to put something on par with God or even elevate that something above God? What is it that you need to have in your life? What is it that has to be the way that you want it in your life for you to be happy? That's most likely your God. Philip Ryken, in his preaching on this passage, notes that the Christian who has no God but God is not shy about God. When they're asked questions about the gospel and about Jesus, they're not cowardly in telling the truth about God. They're proud of who God is. And so they'll speak up. There's another test. Do you feel like you have to apologize for saying that Jesus is the only way? Do you have to apologize or feel embarrassed because you don't believe that much of what's going on around us is okay? That the sin so easily embraced around us is bad? Do you feel the need to apologize for being different because you follow Jesus? No. And I would add that the Christian who has no God but God is not hesitant to put Christ first. They run after that. They chase after that and say, God first, God first, God first in every part of their life. And if our involvement in church, if our attendance at church is crowded out by other things, we're limping between two opinions. Now, I'm not saying that every Christian needs to be at every church event that's ever offered. No, of course not. But I am saying, if we try to work our participation in the body of Christ in where it can fit, instead of placing it front and central and fitting other things in where it's appropriate, something's out of whack. God will have no rivals. God will not share his throne. He will not share his glory. He will not allow his people to elevate anything to that level and leave it there, which is precisely why we have the rest of this story. The entirety of this chapter is about God saying, you need to treat me as God and nothing else. That's the point. Now look at how this plays out. Elijah suggests the following, verses 23 and following. Let two bulls be given to us, and let them choose one bull for themselves and cut it in pieces and lay it on the wood, but put no fire to it. And I will prepare the other bull and lay it on the wood and put no fire to it. And you call upon the name of your God, and I will call upon the name of the Lord, and the God who answers by fire, he is God. And all the people answered, it is well spoken. Okay? So he throws down this challenge. Basically, it looks like this. We've got a couple of bulls. You guys pick the one you want. You cut it up. You put it on the wood like a campfire kind of scenario. But don't light the fire. You ask your God to light that fire. I'll do the same thing with whichever bull you leave behind. I'll cut it up. I'll put it on the wood. I'll ask my God, the Lord, to light that fire. And whichever God shows up and lights the fire, that's the real God. That's the one that we're going to follow. Who agrees to that? I love this. And all the people answered, it is well spoken. The false prophets don't say, yeah, good idea, right? It's the crowd. It's the whole gathering of people, perhaps including the false prophets, but it's not just the prophets. Elijah has backed them into a corner where their public opinion hangs in the balance. And so they agree to this showdown. We know from the way that the rest of the chapter goes that this is a life or death showdown. Everybody's going up the mountain, but not everybody's coming back down on their own accord, right? But this is not like the old Western movie duel. It's different in at least two ways. In the old Western duel, the two guys get back to back, they pace off, they turn and face each other, they shoot, right? Or maybe they just start out at a distance and face each other and they pull the trigger. Here, Elijah and the 450 false prophets are not allowed to pull the trigger. They have to ask their God to show up and do it. They cannot take the decisive action. The point is that God, whichever God is the real God, has to show up and do something. The second way that it's different is that in the old Western duels, when do they shoot? The same time, right? They're both waiting, and they get their hand on their hip, and they're watching, waiting for somebody to move. And as soon as one person starts doing a move, they both do it. And it's an instantaneous, almost identical same-time thing. That's not how it plays out here. They don't do it at the same time. Look at verse 25. Elijah said to the prophets of Baal, choose for yourself one bull and prepare it first. For you are many, and call upon the name of your God, and put no fire to it. He doesn't just say, you guys get first pick, I'll take what's left, and we'll do it at the same time. He says, you guys go first. I mean, there's a lot of you. We'll let you guys have first dibs. This is sudden death over time, and he says, you can have the ball first. Sure. He does nothing to try to stop them from being successful. Nothing. In fact, he gives them hours and hours before he even steps off the bench and walks onto the court. He gives them home court advantage, right? You guys go first. Pick the bull you want. Get it set up. I'll give you hours and hours. It goes from morning to noon to evening sacrifice time. Yeah, go ahead. I'll wait. He just sits there waiting and waiting. He's not in a hurry. It's not simply about God being proved true. It's about Baal being proved false. He gives them home court advantage in that Baal was supposed to be the god of sun and heat and storm. He should have been able to pull off a little lightning, right? Just one little lightning strike. Just one bolt. That'll do it, right? And he's outnumbered. Elijah versus 450 prophets of Baal, verse 22. And the 400 prophets of Asherah are there as well, verse 19. I picture this being a little bit like a high school sporting event, right? You've got the varsity team on the court. And you get the JV team in the stands cheering them on, right? It's Baal on the court and Asherah in the stands ready to root their team on. And then the other team fields a single player all by himself. And he spends the first 98% of the game sitting on the bench. The other ones just keep trying to shoot at the basket and they can't make a single hoop. Verse 26. And they took the bull that was given them, and they prepared it, and called upon the name of Baal from morning until noon, saying, oh, Baal, answer us. But there was no voice, and no one answered. And they limped around the altar that they had made. Now, that's really important. Remember what happened at the beginning. Elijah says, how long will you go on limping? And the people's response was silence. Limping people, silent people. Now, we have a limping group of prophets and a silent, false God. And so they keep doing their dance around their altar, trying to get their God's attention. And the response of that God is silence. No answer at all. They try to entice their false God to speak, to act, to manifest, to do something. And nothing. And then it gets good. 27. And at noon, Elijah mocked them, saying, cry aloud, for he is a God, Either he is musing, or he is relieving himself, or he is on a journey, or perhaps he is asleep and must be awakened. I'm sorry, if you don't like that, you need to wake up. That's hilarious. That's outstanding. Elijah is biting and sarcastic and brutal. He mocks these false prophets who had been leading God's people astray. Hey, cry aloud. Get louder. Maybe your God can't hear you. He's a God, right? He should be able to hear you. Be louder. Maybe he's musing. Maybe he's just so lost in thought he's not paying attention. You got to kind of snap him out of it. Maybe he's relieving himself. That might be my favorite line in all of the Bible. Hey, guys, maybe your God's in the boys' room. Maybe he's got the stall door locked and you got to get his attention. Maybe your God is so busy doing number one or number two that he can't be bothered to answer you. That's in the Bible. That's the word of God to his people right there. That's outstanding. Maybe he's on a journey. Maybe he's wandering and you got to kind of get a little telegram out to him wherever he's at. Maybe your God's sleepy. Maybe your God just gets tired. He's taking a little nappy time. Wake him up, people. I love this. I would love to be able to see an instant replay of this someday, and I hope that in eternity we get to do that. This is fantastic. If somebody ever tells you the whole Bible's boring, you know right away that person has never read the Bible, because this is wonderful. So how do they respond to being mocked? How do these 450 people respond to a single dude making fun of them? 28, 29. And they cried aloud and cut themselves after their custom with swords and lances until the blood gushed out upon them. And as midday passed, they raved on until the time of the offering of the oblation. But there was no voice. No one answered. No one paid attention. So from midday when the mocking's going on till the evening oblation, or as the NIV puts it, evening sacrifice, right? All afternoon goes by. And they start cutting themselves as they're passing. So they're bleeding all over as they dance around. And they're raving. And they're being loud. They're doing whatever they can to get their God's attention. Nothing. There was no voice. No one answered. No one paid attention. It's not just that Baal was out there and didn't answer. No one paid attention. There was no such thing as Baal. There is no false god Baal. It's a made-up non-entity. There was no one to even hear their prayers, because they're not worshiping the one God who is true. He's a nothing. He's a no one. Elijah's showdown looks like three things. It looks like, number one, lay out the issue. There's one God. Who is it? Who are you going to follow as God? Step two, disprove the false God, which is what he's done to this point. Baal didn't answer. Baal didn't provide. That hasn't changed. If you have anything or anyone other than the one true God as your God, you're going to find that God cannot answer you, cannot help you, can't meet the genuine, deepest needs of your life. God created you for himself, and you cannot fill a God-sized hole in your life with the littler things that he has made. You will get no answer for the deepest, eternal, most significant issues in your life from anything or anyone but the one true God. Step three of the showdown is let God prove himself true. The false prophets have had their turn. Now it's Elijah's turn. Or more accurately, it's God's turn, and Elijah warms up the crowd before God takes the stage. Verse 30 and following. Then Elijah said to all the people, "Come near. Come near to me." And all the people came near to him, and he repaired the altar of the Lord that had been thrown down. Elijah took 12 stones according to the number of the tribes of the son of Jacob, to whom the word of the Lord came, saying, "Israel should be your name." And with the stones he built an altar in the name of the Lord, and he made a trench around the altar as great as would contain 2 seahs of seed. So he's got to rebuild the altar. It's been let go. He fixes it up. 12 stones representing the 12 tribes of Israel. This is about the entirety of God's people, all 12 tribes, all of God's people coming together to refollow, to turn back to the one true God, gets it set up, and he digs a trench around the altar. enough to hold two seahs of seed. A seah, two seahs of seed, would be something like 7 quarts in the way that we measure today. So this is a little less, you know, than 2 gallons. It's something like 1 3/4 gallons worth of area that it would hold. He rebuilt it, and then check this out. Verse 33, 34, 35. And he put the wood in order and cut the bull in pieces and laid it on the wood. And he said, fill 4 jars with water and pour it on the burnt offering and on the wood. And then he said, do it a second time. And they did it a second time. And he said, do it a third time. And they did it a third time. And the water ran around the altar and filled the trench also with water. So he's got the altar, stone altar, sets up the wood, puts the meat on the wood, and then says, get jars of water, 4 jars of water, douse it, soak it with water. They do that. That's not how you start a fire. I don't know if you've been camping. That's a bad start right there. And he says, do it again. They do it again. Do it again. They do it a third time. That's the worst way to start a fire I've ever heard of. This is a terrible start. There's enough water that not only is the meat that needs to be cooked wet, the wood has been drenched with water, and the trench around it is overflowing. There's more than 7 quarts of extra water beyond what's flowed out beyond that. If you and I were there, we would not be able to light this. We'd have our little lighter, and we'd hold it up, and nothing's catching. We'd be lucky to start this fire with a blowtorch and then blowing on it and kind of maybe start to get a little smoke. We wouldn't be able to get this fire started with our modern technology. How does Elijah light it? He doesn't. God does. But look at how that happens. Elijah prays, God answers. Elijah seeks the one true God, and that God responds. If you go to James chapter 5, we're not told this story as a special event. We're told in James chapter 5, this is normal for the people of God. He, Elijah, was a man with a nature just like ours. Elijah wasn't elite. Elijah was normal. And so when we come to a God, the God, the one true God, we should expect response just as Elijah got response. Elijah prays, God answers. Not like Baal, who was powerless to hear or to answer. But as I read through Elijah's prayer, I want you to listen very carefully to what Elijah does and does not ask for. At the time of the offering of the oblation, Elijah the prophet came near and said, O Lord, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, let it be known this day that you are God in Israel, and that I am your servant, and that I have done all these things at your word. Answer me, O Lord, answer me, that this people may know that you, O Lord, are God, and that you have turned their hearts back. I hear no mention of fire in there. Now, it's implied, but what is his real ask? He's saying, God, show them that you're God. And God, show them that you're bringing them back to yourself. That's the heartbeat. He says, I'm just doing what you told me to do. Help them realize it's not about me, that it's all about you. You're the one God, and that you're bringing them back to you. That's the prayer. Fire is just a means of answering it. The prayer is that God would be God of his people alone. I love that. I told you earlier that from verse 21 that this story is about knowing that there's only one God, and it's the God of the Bible. And here in the prayer, we find that same priority once again. God will not accept being seen as one among many. Elijah doesn't just want that. He wants them to see that and respond to it. He wants them to see that and know that God is calling them back to himself. It's not enough that they say, oh, we've been wrong. Too late for us. No, he wants them to see, we've been wrong. The God of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, what we would call the God of the Bible, is the one true God. And that they would return to him. They'd see that God is doing this not simply to tell them they're wrong, but to invite them back to himself. If you are in a place today where there is something misordered about your priorities, where you haven't been following God the way you should, God is not telling you that you're wrong so that you know you're wrong. He's calling you back. He's saying, return to me. Follow me. Be with me. That's the God that we serve. And God sent fire. Oh, did God send fire? A lightning strike that lit the wood would have done it, right? If there had been a lightning strike the way it might hit a tree and there's some smoldering and some fire that comes from that, that would have won the duel, right? That's not what God does. God's glory is on the line, and God pulls out all the stops. If there had just been a little fire from, say, a lightning strike or something, it would have ended up with an ongoing sort of campfire, and the wood would have burned, and the meat would have started cooking. And that would have been kind of similar to how the Old Testament sacrifices played out, you know, when people brought their animal, and the priests cut it up, and they put it over the fire, and they had their intentional grilling session. But that's not how God does it here. Look at 38. Then the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt offering and the wood and the stones and the dust and licked up the water that was in the trench. Boom! It's gone. Fire falls and everything's gone. It's not that the meat is cooked. It's obliterated. It's not that the wood catches fire. The wood is completely burned up and gone. The stones are gone. The dust is gone. The extra water in the trench is gone. This is napalm to the millionth power. Boom. Gone. Done. Have you ever seen a fire so hot that rocks are gone? That's what God does here. Right? It's not just a wet fire that somehow God gets going. Like, boom, there's nothing left. Like, hey, you remember before the prayer? We had this big pile of rocks, 12 rocks, et cetera, et cetera. No rocks. God answered. Right? I love that. God is not just enough. He doesn't show up in a way like, okay, I'm a little better than the alternative. God is amazing. As Kyle led us in worship this morning, we talked about the majesty and greatness of God. That's on display here. And the people are done limping. They're done being silent. Verse 39, and when all the people saw it, they fell on their faces and said, "The Lord, He is God. The Lord, He is God." I want to know how they said that. I would love to know if this was like amazement. The Lord, He is God. The Lord, He is God. Like just mind blown from what they saw. Or was there a bit of godly fear in this? Like, the Lord, He's God. Yeah, we get it now. The Lord, He's God. I don't know. It might have been both. It might have depended on which one you were talking to in the crowd. But they get it. But all had failed utterly. And the people destroyed the false prophets. They destroyed those who'd been leading them astray. We read in the text, and they seized them, and Elijah brought them down to the brook Kishon and slaughtered them there. That's offensive to modern sensibilities, but it's right in at least two ways. Number one, it is the Old Testament law's requirement in this situation. False prophets face the death penalty under God's law. They should have been put to death for this. Number two, when you find that you're chasing after a false god, get rid of that. You don't say, oh, well, you know, that's a bad idea, but I'm going to keep it around so it continues to tempt me, right? You get rid of whatever it is that's drawing you into that false god limping. You do what you need to get rid of it. Years ago, I was meeting with and encouraging a brother who was caught in things he shouldn't be. And he found that he was accessing those things with his smartphone. And for the sake of his marriage, and for the sake of his walk with Jesus, he said, I can't do this anymore. And he didn't simply commit to not doing that. He said, I'm selling my smartphone and I'm buying a flip phone so that I don't even have access to this anymore. That's exactly right. You don't negotiate with temptation. You don't keep it around to draw you astray. You eradicate it every opportunity you have. And so they do. And then we get this weird ending to the chapter that we're tempted to skip past, but we can't. Baal had failed in the fire showdown, which should have been his area of expertise. And now he fails in the rain showdown, which was his other go-to claim to fame. 3.5 years have been going by, and the Baal followers have been unable to get their God to provide rain. But now, at showdown time, Elijah says, now it's time to pray and ask God to send the rain. And the rain comes that very day. so much rain that he tells the Ahab, basically, you better get going with your chariot or you ain't going to make it home. The roads are going to wash out. It's going to be too muddy for you to even drive your chariot home. You better get going now, right? Massive rain, not just a little trickle. At every turn, Baal was demonstrated to be nothing. And God showed himself to be everything. We cannot leave this as a historical fact. It is historical. It is fact. This did happen. But that's not enough. We have to ask today for ourselves and for our generation, who is God? I am not here to prove God to you. I can't. That's not my job. That's God's job. But I want to suggest two answers to that question. The first is to remind you of the cross. God has proved himself at the cross. He has shown his love for his people. He has proven that he is the God who takes sin seriously and grace and forgiveness seriously. If you want to know who God really is, if you want to know how real God is, you look to the cross and you look to what God has done in Jesus Christ for you. And you preach that to yourself over and over and over. I was talking to a younger brother in the faith just the other day. And he said, I just struggle to believe that I'm okay with God, that with all the mess ups and all the times I struggle to want to read my Bible and stuff, that God's actually okay with me. I said, you preach the gospel to yourself over and over. Every day, or 10 times a day, or 1,000 times a day as you need it. And he said, yeah, but you and other people, you guys have it together. I'm like, no, we don't. We have to do that same thing. We have to keep reminding ourselves of who God is. Second, I'm going to go out on a limb, except I know it's not a limb. And I'm going to tell you, God will prove himself true in your life. I am not claiming that God will do it in a campfire obliterating way the way he did here. The way that God manifested himself in 1 Kings 18 was specific to their needs in that situation. But God is not absentee. God is present and active in 2020 and in your life as a believer in Jesus Christ. And I believe that if you turn to him, if you ask him to help you trust him, to know that he is really God, that he's going to answer that. Because just like in 1 Kings 18, his glory is on the line. And if you come to him and say, God, would you show yourself to me to be real? God will find the appropriate way to reveal himself to you in a way that is suitable to your context. I'm not saying that you can put God to the test and say, you must do it in this way. I'm saying God will come up the way. And he'll show up and prove himself faithful. Don't doubt that he will. And if God is not true, if God is not real, don't follow him. I'm not calling you to a worldview called Christianity. I am calling you to follow the one true God, period. The one who has sent his son, Jesus Christ. That's the God we follow. And if he's not real, don't bother with him. But he is real. And in your life, you will find he will prove himself over and over again. Let's pray. God, it's so easy to get distracted. It's so easy to take the things that we see with our eyes and prioritize those things, love those things, adore those things, follow those things. But they're at best things. And half the time, they're made up realities in our own minds. But you are real. You are the Lord, L-O-R-D, all capitals, the God of the burning bush, the God whose name is I Am. I am who I am. You're the definition of reality. You're the basis for our existence. We want to know you as God and God alone. We want you to obliterate in our lives every false god, every idol, every altar that we set up to make too much of something else. Father, I ask right now, I pray that you would reveal yourself to these people as God, as the only God. Would you do it in the way that seems right to you, in the timing that is good in your perfect wisdom? But would you do it for every one of us here in this place, that we would know that you are God and that you are calling us to yourself? Don't leave us in condemnation for having wavered. Leave us encouraged and steadfast in following you. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.